fair competition.
Yeah, but you're going to keep the choir today.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So you'll have your class the whole way.
Well, my voice is not as good as that of someone else here in the room, but the person for whom I would like to sing happy birthday is Larry Hopson, who, as you know, I regard as the best pastor in all this area. It's true. It's been true for a long time. So, happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Larry. Happy birthday to you. And many more.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for coming back for the continuation of our exploration of the subject, Jesus Means Freedom. And up until today, we have focused on how Jesus brought freedom to other people, to the sick, to the downhearted, right? To the demon-possessed. Today, however, I would like to focus with your help on Jesus himself, on his development, his journey toward freedom. And I think that's appropriate for Advent, right? That we focus on Jesus himself. As you know, his origins were obscure. Ordinary people living in the countryside. According to a tradition found in the proto-gospel of James, a gospel that didn't quite make it into the New Testament, Mary, just a girl, made her living as a seamstress. And the man who eventually took him as his son, legally, and gave him a name, Joseph, was just a carpenter. Just a carpenter. The first 12 years of his life were spent in almost total obscurity. Luke only, the Gospel of Luke, tells us one story. He went with his parents to the temple at the age of
12.
And something happened there. When his parents could not find him, they searched the city of Jerusalem. They found him where? In the temple, debating with the scribes, the experts in the law. And when his mother chided him for his absence, he said something enigmatic, something profound, something that was very much like the kind of thing that the adult man would say later. He said, I must be, and the Greek can be translated two different ways. I must be what? About my father's business? Or I must be in my father's place. House, right. And he's not talking about Joseph. So there at the age of 12, you can see the dawning of a consciousness.
Yes, but his mother was justified in being...
She was. Absolutely, she was justified. According to Luke, they had already journeyed a couple of days on the road back to Galilee. They assumed that he was with friends among the pilgrims. So, absolutely, she was justified. My mother would have been just as upset with me. And then 18 more years go by. He worked as a carpenter, provided for his mother and his siblings. Four brothers are known by name. Mark mentions sisters, plural. And then when he was how old? 30-something, Luke says. About 30. One day, He walked away from the carpenter's bench, went to the Jordan River. One of the best moments in our class this semester was when Larry Hofsis pointed out that when he came back from the Jordan River and from the wilderness and went to the synagogue for his first sermon and read the scroll of Isaiah and then announced, "Today, this day, these words are fulfilled in your hearing." When the text is read carefully, it suggests that Jesus himself was awakening into a consciousness of the calling that God had placed upon his heart. When I teach my course on Jesus at Fordham University in New York City, a bunch of undergraduates, most of them headed into business or finance, but good-hearted young people. And when I'm looking for language to describe what happened in the case of Jesus, I find myself using the language of awakening. I think that's what the text suggests, especially those two Gospels, Mark and Luke. They paint the picture, or they tell the story, of a very human Jesus. Luke says he grew how? In wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and human beings. And the more I read this story, the more I investigate individual text with your help, I find myself more sensitive to development in the case of Jesus, to evolution in his understanding. That's why I use that language of awakening. So I'd like to move forward now in the story, and I'd like to focus on a dramatic moment of awakening, a turning point. Very definitely a turning point in the liberating work of Jesus. And that point is Jesus' decision to leave Galilee, to leave the sunlit plains where he had preached those beautiful parables and announced that God reigns, where he had proclaimed release to the captives, where crowds had flocked to him, seeking to be made whole and free. Why didn't he just stay there? Why did he leave and go to Jerusalem? The decision to go to Jerusalem is clearly identified by the earliest gospel, Mark, as the turning point in the life of Jesus. Here's how Mark introduces it. Already in chapter 6, verse 31, Mark says that when Jesus learned of the death, the violent execution of his own cousin, who?
John
the Baptist, by beheading, a political murder. When Jesus learned about that, Mark says, he withdrew to a wilderness place. He retreated.
So he was not all-knowing, was he?
No.
He didn't know that.
That's
somebody
exactly
had to tell him.
That's exactly right. This may scandalize some people, but the way Mark tells the story, Jesus didn't have it all worked out. In fact, even on the cross, Mark's Jesus speaks only one time. Did you know that? in the total darkness. You only get the seven words by putting all the Gospels what?
Together.
Mark's Jesus speaks only once. In the darkness, he cries out what?
My God.
My God. My God. Why? His last words were a prayer. They are the first line of a psalm of lament from the Old Testament. And they are a question. His last words were a question. He died with a question on his lips. He didn't have it all worked out. But we believe, those of us who are gathered here, hoping that he will show us the way to live in our difficult time. A time of migration of people, of growing inequality, of the threat now of global climate change. And we need more than ever the faith that God answered that question with which Jesus died, and that His life is still the answer for me. And that's why I'm focused on this decision that Jesus made to go to Jerusalem, to leave the sunny valleys of Galilee, where his work was celebrated, where the crowds of people flocked to him, to leave all of that and to go to Jerusalem. And the way Mark tells the story, at first, he withdrew. He withdrew into the wilderness. And then, in chapter 8, Jesus calls the 12, just the 12, to him, apart from the crowd. And he informs them, for the first time, that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and will be killed. Now the shock of those words is clearly registered in the earliest gospel, Mark. Mark doesn't try to hide how Peter responded. Peter responded how? Don't say that, Jesus. That's not going to happen. Mark says that Peter rebuked Jesus when he heard the decision that he had made. And then Jesus rebuked Peter and said what?
Get behind me,
Satan. In the words of Peter, in the assertion that it wasn't necessary to go to Jerusalem for a showdown with the authorities, Jesus himself experienced, according to Mark, a temptation. He heard the voice of who? Satan. Tempting him, as he had in the wilderness. He heard that voice again coming through Peter. And after that first conversation with Peter, on two further occasions in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 9, verse 31, chapter 10, verses 32 to 33, Jesus repeats his resolve to go to Jerusalem. He tells the disciples that he must suffer. The Greek word that is used here is very interesting. It's a little impersonal verb, dei. Does anyone know what that means? It means it is necessary. That's the conclusion that he had come to. In other words, he didn't think that suffering was regrettable but avoidable in principle. He had come to the conclusion that it was necessary.
I was wondering, you know, disciples always had a hard time with all this stuff. I wonder if maybe Jesus was kind of saying things that were put into him by God, kind of like a person speaking in tongues, but speaking in something they could understand. They come out from time to time. The rest of the time, he acted more like everybody else, and so they couldn't really quite connect between the two phenomena going on.
That's very interesting. In both the Gospel of Mark and in the Gospel of John, the Gospel writers say that the disciples didn't understand Jesus at the time. But it was only later, what? In remembrance, that they understood what he did. So I think that the misunderstanding of Jesus by the disciples is not just a literary motif in the Gospel of Mark. It's not just part of Mark's theology, which is what William Rada taught us, right, in his book, The Messianic Secret. I think it's historical. I think they didn't understand. And Jesus himself was only gradually coming to understand what was called for. So I think it's historical. And even if the language in which all of this is formulated, even if the language is Markan, and even if it resonates with Mark's theology, what is clearly historical is the decision, the resolve. He didn't stay in Galilee. That's a fact. He decided to leave and go to Jerusalem. And of course, we wonder, don't we, whether he had a premonition of what waited for him there. Mark chapter 11. Mark describes Jesus' approach to Jerusalem. And what I want to suggest is that there is evidence that Jesus stage managed his entry into the city. Passover pilgrims who came down to Jerusalem approached the city how? On foot. The Mishnah, the code of Jewish law, tells us that that was a requirement. But what did Jesus do? He sent his disciples ahead of him into the city to get a donkey. And he entered the city how? Mounted. Does anyone hear an echo in the room? It is clearly an evocation by Jesus of the prophet Zechariah. The prophet, these are the clearest clues that we get to what was going on inside the mind and the heart of Jesus. The clues are there. Zechariah chapter 9, listen to this. It describes the approach of the divine warrior. Rejoice greatly, O daughter Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter Jerusalem. Lo, your king comes to you. Triumphant and victorious is he. Humble and riding upon what? A donkey. Now listen to what comes next. He will cut off the battle chariot from Ephraim and the war horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off, and he shall command peace to the nations. In other words, the divine warrior of Zechariah 9 demilitarizes. Demilitarizes the city. Jesus' message, I think, in deliberately stage managing, it's like a visual parable, right? It's an action parable. And Jesus' message is clear. He is beginning to accept the role of the Messiah, God's agent. He had been reluctant to accept it earlier. Earlier in the text, when the demon-possessed greet him as the anointed one, the Messiah, and when those who are healed say that he is the Messiah, Jesus responds in the Gospel of Mark, how? Don't tell anyone about that. Be quiet. But now he is embracing the role, but by evoking Zechariah 9, the one who will cut off the battle bow, who will break the battle chariot, Jesus is saying that as Messiah, he is the Messiah of peace. Yes, if God wants it, if God says, if he comes to the conclusion that it is necessary for someone to die for it. Years ago, yes.
Do we at this point believe that Jesus was aware of Zechariah 9?
Oh yes, absolutely, absolutely. Jesus, like other pious Jews of the period, was absolutely saturated in the language of the prophets. And the archaeological discoveries, like the huge collection of texts that were found at the Dead Sea Scrolls, we know that in this time period, Isaiah, Zechariah, right, were popular reading for Jews in this period. So, yes, I assume that. In fact, the correlation between Jesus' activity and certain passages in the prophets, not only Zechariah 9, but Isaiah 32 and Isaiah 35, where the one whom God has designated as the agent, the one whom God has anointed to carry out God's work, is the one who will bring good news to the poor, sight to the blind, hearing to the deaf, the one who will proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. The correlation between these passages and the words and deeds of Jesus is so complete that the oldest and coldest historians, people like Rudolf Bultmann, whose picture looks out at me every day from the wall of my office at Fordham. I have a great picture of him that was sent to me by Paul Seebeck, the publisher of More Seebeck. The oldest and coldest historians acknowledge that the correlation here is so complete that we have to posit that intention is at work. The only question is, whose intention? Is it the intention of the authors, right? Or is it the intention of Jesus himself? Did Jesus himself gradually accept the necessity? The necessity of acting as God's agent. Yes.
We tend to read back into the images of the Messiah in
right.
the Old Testament
right.
and make them very clear because you read them through Jesus himself.
Yeah.
Was part of Jesus growing into this retarded or staged a little bit because it was relatively unclear as to what do we mean by Messiah?
Thank you.
When you get to his point.
Thank you.
So you read Zechariah and the Son of Man. Well, there's one image. And
right.
We're not too clear about that. And then when you read about, we're going to clear up the military situation. When he goes to Jerusalem, what then is his focus?
Right.
The only people that had chariots would have been the Romans. So
right.
was it a political piece, or was it
such a good question?
What was it, a Jewish situation, more of an inner piece?
Good.
So growing into it is kind of taking a lot of fragments and adding clarity to them.
Exactly. That's absolutely right. If Jesus is accepting the role of God's agent, and that person has various names, right,
yeah,
in the Jewish tradition. In Isaiah, he is the servant.
Mm-hmm.
He is, in Daniel and Ezekiel, the son of man. In other passages of Isaiah, he is the one anointed, Messiah, the one anointed by God. But what was expected of this figure? That's what's not clear in Second Temple Judaism. Let me give you one fact. Stunning for us now, 2,000 years later, knowing what we do about the fate of Jesus. But did you know, has anyone ever told you, that no Jewish text prior to the Gospel of Mark ever speaks of the Messiah as dying? Did you know that? There's not one Jewish text that speaks about the death or suffering of the Messiah. That was not part, that wasn't expected. Some years ago, a historian at the Oriental Institute at the University of Chicago thought he had discovered in one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, a very fragmentary text, the expression, the Messiah, the Messiah, will die. But then a professor at Harvard pointed out that the Hebrew text of the Dead Sea Scrolls was written only with consonants and no vowels, and therefore the word that the man at Chicago translated will die could also be translated how? Will kill. not will die, but will kill. Will put to death the enemies of God. So I agree with you. In growing into this, in accepting the necessity of what God wanted, God's will for his life, we can't make the mistake of assuming that there was a well-defined understanding of who the Messiah was. But Jesus' own words in the Gospel of Mark tell us that something new is happening. Jesus speaks about the Son of Man, the necessity of the Son of Man doing what? Suffering. And dying. An idea that has no parallel in Messianic Jewish text of the period. Yes.
So when Jesus took up his ministry at the age of 30, did he have this already, this knowledge or acceptance?
It's not clear to me that he did. I hope this doesn't make me a heretic, but I don't think there is any reading of the Gospel of Mark that would lead you to the conclusion that he had all this worked out.
Right.
He only begins to talk about himself as the Son of Man. He only begins to talk about the necessity of his suffering in the middle of Mark's Gospel, at that turning point, after he learns about the death of whom?
John
the Baptist. So from that point on, it appears to me that he saw what was coming. He understood what would be necessary. Albert Schweitzer, the great medical missionary, seems to have understood this better than anyone after him. Schweitzer said that when Jesus in Galilee got the information that his cousin John had been killed, a political murder, that Jesus himself understood that the world was not going to change, that society was not going to be redeemed just by preaching sermons. and healing people, that something more was required. In unforgettable language, you know, Schweitzer was such a great writer. Schweitzer said that when Jesus understood that the reign of God was not going to come easily, just by preaching about it, Schweitzer said he resolved to go to Jerusalem and cast himself upon the wheel of the world to stop it from turning. Schweitzer was something, wasn't he? You know, he, in addition to being a New Testament scholar and a medical doctor, he had a degree in psychology as well. And he published in German a little book called The Psychology of Jesus. It has never been translated into English. Did you know that?
No.
I think it was never translated because people just weren't ready for it.
Also one of the world's great organs.
Yes.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I need to bring with me to class. I have a photocopy. It's not the original. I have a photocopy of a letter written by Albert Schweitzer to one of my first students that I taught in Chicago, an elderly man, a priest, who wrote to Schweitzer while he was in Africa and asked him, did you find Jesus there with the people to whom you ministered? And it's only about a 5-line letter written in Schweitzer's own handwriting, written, by the way, in French, not German. And he tells this young priest, yes, yes, I found him.
One question. Back to your idea of Jesus translating. Moving on. At 30, wouldn't he have become the head of the household like
that's
the Romans did?
Right, that's very interesting.
And then he left that responsibility and that money and the command to his younger brothers?
Yes. Joseph disappears from the story, right, after the age of 12. We don't know what happened to Joseph, but the most natural assumption, I think, is that Joseph what?
Died.
According to the proto-gospel of James, he was an elderly widower when he took Mary as his wife. So, from sometime, not long, I would say, after the age of 12, until he walked away from the carpenter's bench at the age of 30, Jesus was the eldest son, the primary financial support for a rather large family. For a widowed mother, 4 brothers, sisters plural. We don't know how many.
So when the family went to the synagogue to retrieve him, they must thought he had lost his marbles, right?
They thought he had lost his mind. That's exactly right. John, the God author, Mark, the author of the oldest gospel, doesn't conceal from us the fact that his mother and his brothers thought he had lost his mind. There's a scholar in Canada. I mentioned his work earlier. John Miller, the New Testament scholar, the chair of the Historical Jesus Seminar at the Society of Biblical Literature. But before he became a New Testament scholar, he was a psychologist. And he wrote a wonderful little book. I would recommend it. It's called Jesus at 30. He's focused on the age 30 crisis. Why did he leave the carpenter's bench? Why did he attract women? Right? Why did he ask this question? Why? Right? And John Miller says that until the age of 30, Jesus was the primary support of a rather large family, and that he spent those years caring for others. He learned how to care for a rather large family. And then gradually he extended that ethos of caring to whom? To the sick, to the possessed, to the poor, right? If you're courageous enough to actually think about the psychological development of Jesus, in my opinion, the story becomes much more moving. But Jesus' message, when he enters the city like this, mounted upon a donkey, acting out the prophecy of Zechariah, he's telling us that he is willing to accept the necessity of playing the role of God's agent, but that in that role, he will be the Messiah of peace. Well, Mark's account of the response of the crowds suggests that people understood the message of his action. What did they do? They spread their cloaks on the ground. They cut down what?
Palm branches
and spread them. And this gesture, welcoming someone, was well known in the ancient world. The famous Cato, after whom there is an institute now, named in Washington, D.C. When Cato retired from his service to the Roman people, the soldiers and the people cast their cloaks on the ground in front of him to welcome him back to the city.
And it didn't last long, did it?
No. And they kissed his hands. So the crowd forms a procession. Some of them already behind Jesus, others in front of him. And what are they shouting?
Hosanna.
Do you know what that means?
Save,
please. Right? Please save. And then they say what? Blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord. Now that is a benediction from Psalm 118. And it turns out that this psalm is a liturgy of thanksgiving for the procession on the way to the temple, to the portals of Yahweh. It's a hymn of national thanksgiving for salvation. And in the Jewish liturgical calendar, guess what it is connected with? Zechariah chapter 9. Specifically, Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9. Now, at this point in the Gospel of Mark, there is a tremendous anticlimax. Jesus comes into the city, surrounded by a crowd of Passover pilgrims, who are welcoming him as what? The one who comes in the name of the Lord. He goes sweeping up the mountain to the temple, and according to Mark chapter 11, verse 11, Jesus looks around and does what? Goes away. Goes out to the Mount of Olives and spends the night. And it's only the next day that he gets up and returns to the temple and takes an action against the temple that leads to the attempt to arrest him and to kill him. Now, in between the account of the triumphal entry mounted on the donkey, in between that account and the account of the action against the temple in the Gospel of Mark is one of the most bizarre stories in the Gospel of Mark. It's the episode of the cursing of the fig tree. You remember this story?
Yeah.
Jesus is on his way out to the Mount of Olives after having just looked around in the temple, and he sees a fig tree at a distance, and he is hungry, and he sends the disciples to go get him some figs, and guess what? There is no fruit because it's not the season for figs. And so Jesus gets angry and does what? Curses the poor fig tree. And a very uncharacteristic gesture. The only time in the gospel when Jesus does anything like that. And the next morning, when they are coming back to the temple, the disciples look over there and the poor fig tree has what? Withered away to the roots. Now, I understand the desire for figs. Diane would tell you, if she were here today, that if necessary, I could probably live on figs. I love them so much. The last couple of years, we've rented a little house near to the ruins of Roman Corinth so that I can pursue my research in dialogue with the archaeologist. And the house that we rent, Joan, has a fig tree in the backyard. And so every year, May, June, I go there looking for figs. But guess what? There are no figs until August. That's the season. Now, as disappointed as I have been, it has never occurred to me to do what? Curse the fig tree. Okay. A long time ago, back in the 1920s, two German Lutheran scholars, Rudolf, my scholarly grandfather, Rudolf Bultmann, and his contemporary, Martin Debailius. They were both working on the analysis of the passion narrative in the Gospel of Mark, and they both independently came to the recognition that the episode of the cursing of the fig tree has been inserted by Mark into the passion narrative, and that the little story, the bizarre incident of the cursing of the fig tree, is Mark's allegorical commentary on the events that are happening in Jerusalem. Mark is trying to say Jerusalem and the Jewish people were like, they are like what? A fig tree that did not bear fruit and consequently fell under the judgment of God. Okay, here's the payoff of that kind of close analysis of the text. When you remove the story of the cursing of the fig tree, which Mark has added to the passion narrative as a commentary on the events, when you remove that story from the text, guess what happens? The triumphal entry into the city, in which Jesus is surrounded by a large crowd of Passover pilgrims shouting what? Hosanna. That triumphal entry culminates in what? The action against the temple. That's the original sequence of events in the passion narrative. Surrounded by a crowd, a throng of Passover pilgrims, Jesus goes sweeping up the mountain to the temple and takes an action against the temple. Now, in our English Bibles, the action that Jesus takes against the temple is regularly characterized by the little paragraph headings that modern editors insert into the text. It's characterized as what?
Cleansing.
Thank you. The cleansing of the temple. That's the way we refer to it, right? But the assumption here is that the temple was what?
Dirty.
Corrupt. Impure. And that it needs to be what? Cleansed. Back in 1983, the most important book on the historical Jesus since the work of Schweitzer and Bultmann and others was published here in the United States by an American, of all things, a Texan, E.P. Sanders. It's a book called Jesus and Judaism. And what he demonstrated for the first time is that Jesus' action against the temple is wrongly described as a cleansing. The temple was a massive machine for producing purity in the time of Jesus. The animal sellers, what were they doing there?
Selling
kosher animals for sacrifice. Suppose you came down from Galilee, 2 or 3 day journey, carrying in your arms what? A little lamb or a goat or a bird, and you present it to the priest, and he inspects it and sees what?
A blemish.
What are you going to do? Go back to Galilee without sacrifice? Or you can what? Yeah, exchange that animal for one that doesn't have a blemish. What about the money changers? What were they doing in the temple? Well, Roman coins bore upon their face an image of whom? Caesar. I forgot to bring it with me this morning, but my wonderful wife Diane purchased a Roman coin for me and had it made into a keychain. I feel guilty carrying it because the person whose image is on that coin is the wicked Emperor Nero. I wanted Claudius, but he was sold out. And so the money changers are there to change Roman money, which has the image of a human being, into what? The sacred temple half shekel, which doesn't have a human image. In other words, the animal sellers and the money changers are actually preserving what? The purity of the temple. So if the action that Jesus took is not rightly understood as a cleansing, what was he up to? What was he doing? E.P. Sanders argued that when Jesus went in there and started doing what? Overturning the tables of the money changers and driving out the animal sellers, that this was a symbolic action. Jesus enacted the destruction of the temple, Sanders said. A parabolic gesture. And Sanders pointed out that at the trial of Jesus, a few days later, witnesses stood up and said what? We heard him say that he would destroy this temple. And in 3 days, what? Raise up a new one. So Sanders argued that what Jesus did in the temple is better understood as a symbolic action, a symbolic destruction. I think there is a better clue to what was going on in Jesus' mind in the text itself. Mark chapter 11, verse 17. After Jesus has overturned the tables, he stands in the court of the temple and cries out, what? My Father's house should be a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it into what? A den of thieves, a den of robbers. Now, that statement by Jesus is a conflation of two prophetic texts, Isaiah 56:7 and Jeremiah 7:11. In the first century, the animals that were for sale at the temple belonged to a small group of high priestly families who owned the broad pasture land all the way down beyond Bethlehem. Annas and his son-in-law Caiaphas, and another wealthy high priest named Ananias. This small group of wealthy families competed with one another, not only for the control of the temple economy and the thousands of pilgrims that came every year, they also competed for the favor of the Romans. And the son-in-law of Annas, Caiaphas, held the office of high priest for an unprecedented 17 years. What does that tell you? Well, we've heard this word a lot recently in politics, collusion. Collusion between Caiaphas and his family and the Roman governor. This competition, political competition, led to corruption and violence. Josephus, the Jewish historian, reports that the high priest Ananias extorted money from ordinary priests by force, with the result that many poor country priests starved to death. There's another clue in the text to what Jesus was up to. Mark chapter 11, verse 16 says, "And he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple." Now, do you realize the importance of that statement? What sort of a building was the Jerusalem temple? In terms of the space occupied on the top of Mount Zion, the second temple of the Jews was what? The largest temple in the ancient world. It had 12 gates. It was an enormous structure. Is Mark telling us the truth? He would not permit anyone to carry anything through the temple? How would he have done that? Well, remember the crowd of Passover pilgrims that came sweeping up the hill with him into the temple. What is Mark describing? I had dinner with E.P. Sanders not long after his famous book was published. He came, Larry, to Chicago. I was a beginning graduate student, and I took him out to dinner. And I pointed out this verse in Mark 11:16. He would not permit anyone to carry anything through the temple. And I suggested to the great Texan that Mark is suggesting something more than a symbolic gesture. Mark suggests that Jesus and his followers temporarily occupied the temple. Now that, of course, is a very dangerous thing to do in the ancient world. And I would just point out that the later Gospels, Matthew and Luke, they both delete Mark 11:16 from their account because they know how dangerous and inflammatory that was. Now, I want to point out that Jesus' occupation of the temple was, number one, temporary. Number two, it was what? Non-violent. No indication of violence. And that is a stark contrast to the other would-be messiahs of the period. Simon occupied the temple in the year 66. A year later, another messianic pretender, Athrongaeus, occupied the temple. Both of them used violence against the temple authorities, the ruling class of Judea, and both of them were violently executed by the Romans. But in the case of Jesus, his occupation of the temple was temporary and nonviolent. But it led to his death. Mark says that from that point on, the temple authorities were looking for what? A way to arrest Jesus. And they found it in the person of Judas and the pieces of silver. There's one more clue, I think, to what was going on in the mind and the heart of Jesus in the text. And that that clue is found in words that he spoke at the Last Supper. There's a verse there to which I think we have not yet paid enough attention. Now, of course, we are most familiar with the so-called words of institution. This is my what? Body. This is my blood of the new covenant. Clearly, Jesus understood what was about to happen to him as a sacrifice of his own life. But less attention is paid to his last statement at the Last Supper. Mark chapter 14, verse 25. Jesus said, "Truly I say to you, I will not drink again of the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God." Now, this is a solemn prophetic statement. If you translate it literally from Greek, it has the form and the force of an oath. Jesus takes an oath. In other words, he is making an oath. I won't do this again until when? I drink with you in the kingdom of God. Drinking wine for Jews of that period was a symbol of the fulfillment of the reign of God. And again, I think there's probably an allusion to Isaiah chapter 25. Isaiah 25 is a psalm praising God for saving the poor and the weak. Listen to it. "On this mountain, Zion, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wine, of rich food filled with marrow, of well-aged wines strained clear. Then the Lord God will wipe away the tears from all faces." Let me draw the conclusion. The solemn oath that Jesus took at the end of the Last Supper reveals that Jesus knew that he would not live to finish his liberating work. And by means of that supper, he did what? He gave it to us. He gave that work to us. That's the extraordinary importance of what we do when we gather every Sunday for the Eucharist. We continue his dream, his liberating work. Every time we eat that meal together, he gave his work to us in that meal. He took an oath and said, "I won't drink wine with you again until I drink it when? New. In the kingdom of God." But as often as we eat that bread and drink that cup, we what? We show forth his death and his life until he comes. Jesus knew that he would not finish the work for the kingdom of God, and so he gave it to us. Finally, in Gethsemane, there are a couple of clues. Mark, who gives us this very human portrait of a developing, struggling Jesus. Mark chapter 14, verse 30 says, "He began to be distressed and agitated." That's the translation of the New Revised Standard Version. But I'd like to focus literally. The verb, he began, archomai. Mark suggests that for the first time, Jesus is experiencing anxiety over what lies ahead. He is portrayed as actually distressed at his suffering and death. And the next verb, the one that's translated anxious is actually the verb ekthombestai. Can you say that with me? Ekthombestai. You know what it literally means? It means to be astonished, to be surprised. He was surprised. He was amazed that it had come to this. And then the final verb, ademonein, to be anxious, to be full of anxiety. And there's such a contrast here between Mark's portrait of Jesus on the eve of his suffering and death and the heroic portraits of the Maccabean leaders that are celebrated now during the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah. Those Maccabean leaders are composed and brave as they face death. Mark's portrait of Jesus is also very different from Plato's portrait of Socrates before he drinks the hemlock. Socrates shows himself to be what? Indifferent. Yeah? Indifferent to his death and his suffering. But Mark's Jesus says, chapter 14, verse 34, "My soul is surrounded by grief to the point of death." Surrounded by grief. And then finally, Jesus is arrested and he is taken to the house of the high priest, the house of Annas and Caiaphas, for an extrajudicial, nocturnal session of the Sanhedrin. It was illegal for the Sanhedrin to meet at night. But that's what they did. They were so anxious to get rid of him. And when the testimony of the witnesses failed to agree, do you remember what happened next? Caiaphas, the high priest, took matters into his own hands. He goes directly up to Jesus, right into his face, and he says what? "Are you the Messiah? The Son of the Blessed?" And for the first time in the Gospel of Mark, after all those times when Jesus says, "Don't tell anyone that I'm the Messiah," for the first time, keep it a secret, right? For the first time in the Gospel of Mark, in response to the question of the high priest, Jesus says what? In Mark's Gospel, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven." Now, once again, Matthew and Luke retreat from this portrait of Jesus growing, suffering, developing, coming to a resolution. In Matthew and Luke, when the high priest says, "Are you the Messiah?" Jesus answers, "How?
You say I am."
That's what you say, right? Jesus equivocates. Not in Mark. It is such a striking contrast. After all those chapters, when Jesus conceals his identity and tells other people to do what? Keep it a secret. Finally, on the last night, when the high priest asks him, he completely owns the role. He answers yes to the will of God, as he did in the Garden of Gethsemane when he prayed what? "Not my will, but thy will be done." Well, that's Mark's story. For many of us, a surprising story of how Jesus got free. How did he live into the role of the liberator, the redeemer? And I think very much that it is a portrait of Jesus that we need now. We're facing huge problems. It just is so difficult to wake up in the morning and turn on the news, isn't it? people moving all over the globe, mass migrations, asylum seekers, riots in the streets of what?
Paris.
Because of growing inequality. People say, well, you know, Macron rescinded the gas tax, but it was only on the BBC as I drove home from New York that I found out that at the same time that Macron put a gas tax on that affected the drivers of trucks and lorries, he eliminated completely the tax on who? The super rich. Did you know that? He completely abolished the tax on the French upper class. That's what they're so upset about. It's the growth of inequality. And in addition to that, we face political polarization deeper than any time since I've been alive. And frightening change in the world environment, the global environment. And in the midst of all this, I really believe that we need Mark's portrait of Jesus. Mark's account of the one who came to set us free. That's what I want. That's what I want. Larry.
Jesus means freedom.
Yes.
So it must be that he's got to be freed from something that would paralyze the disciples up in Galilee.
Right.
And this must be the fear of protecting self.
Right.
And so when he gets to Jerusalem, I think our understanding of Jesus is that he sort of drops out of heaven as the full-blown, complete person.
Right.
He knows the world is round. He knows everything scientifically.
Right.
And it's hard to back off of that and say,
that's right.
No, he doesn't know everything.
Right.
He's growing into it.
That's right.
So it doesn't mean that the minute that he leaves Galilee and makes this decision that he's freed from all fear, it's a little bit like he buys into God's plan for him.
That's right.
It doesn't mean he doesn't experience, like we do, a little buyer's remorse.
Exactly.
So you gotta grow through your buyer's remorse as well.
Exactly. No one expected the Messiah to die. I don't think Jesus expected it at first. I think Schweitzer understood that. There's a shocking realization that comes over Jesus. I have a personal connection to that moment. My older son was a student down here at the Miami Valley School, and when he went through confirmation, he took it very seriously. He was reading the Gospel of Mark. He was reading the letters of Bonhoeffer from prison. And one day in March or April, I drove down to pick my son up from school. And ordinarily, he would come bouncing out of the classroom and sit down in the car next to me and begin jabbering away in French. But on this occasion, he walked out very slowly with his head down, took his seat in the car next to me. And we had been driving, I guess, for 5 minutes in silence. And finally, he looked over at me and he said, Larry, he said, I've been reading the Gospel of Mark. And he said, I want you to explain to me, why did the best man who ever lived have to die like that? Why was that necessary? He felt it, bless his heart. Now imagine that you're the father of a son like that, right? You come to pick a son like that up after school, and he lays that on you. But that's right, Larry. I think we see, even after Jesus has understood, after the political murder of John the Baptist, and he knows that this is now going to cost somebody something, and that it might be him, even after he understands that intellectually, Mark does not conceal from us the fact that even on the last night, in the Garden of Gethsemane, he prays what? Father, if it were possible, what? Spare me. Let this cup pass from me. But he goes on anyway. In the difficult days that lie ahead for us, that's what we need. That's the picture of Jesus that we need, I think. Ultimately, in the grand scheme of our topic, Jesus means freedom. What we see here in the last part of Jesus' life is that he is now extending the claim of God's reign and the full humanity and freedom that God intended and intends for all of us. Ultimately, Jesus extends that claim over the institutions of society, right? I mean, I think too often we personalize and individualize our faith. We have a little talk. When I was a boy growing up in the South, we sang a little song. I'm going to have a little talk with Jesus. I'm going to tell him all about our troubles. He'll hear our cry. He'll answer by and by. And in that song, the whole dialogue with Jesus takes place where? In the inner garden of the heart. Well, that's not wrong, but the action that Jesus took against the temple indicates that Jesus extended God's liberating will not just over the individual, but over what? The institutions of society. My Father's house should be what? House of prayer for all people. But you've made it into a den of thieves. So he took an action to liberate the institution, the temple. Of course, that's a very challenging picture of Jesus. But the Roman authorities understood what he was aiming at. The titulus that they hung over the cross, which specified the cause of this man's execution, the crime of which he was guilty. The titulus said what? Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. In other words, they understood that his intentions embraced the political and the institutional, not only the personal.
And we like what the captain said at the cross.
We do.
Surely
this man was the Son of God. Yeah, Mark gives the last word about Jesus to that centurion. That centurion understood it. Now, think about that. The centurion had not seen Jesus work a miracle. What had he seen? He had seen him die. Mark's text is very clear. It says, now when the centurion saw that he died in this way, he said, truly this man was the Son of God. I know I've taken too long. I'm sorry. Next week, our last week, guess where we're going? We're going to the resurrection, to the resurrection stories in the Gospels. And what we're going to find out is that in the end, Jesus means freedom from fear. Fear is, this was a surprise to me until I started working on this. Fear is the primal response to the risen Jesus in all of these stories. You may be surprised next week. Ordinarily on Easter Sunday, we do what?
Rejoice.
We rejoice. Not in those early stories. In the early stories, the primal response is fear. And Jesus' resurrection means freedom from fear. That's what we'll talk about next week, if I can get you to come back.
Thank you.